charmer. Beneath that unfailingly sure exterior, Sartak was certainly a shameless flirt. But she considered his implied question, though she had known the answer for years. Otterlin is not as open as the Khaganate when it comes to embracing the role of women in the ranks of its guards or armies, she admitted. While I might be skilled, men usually were promoted. So I was left to rot on patrol duty at the walls or busy streets. Handling the underworld or nobility was left for more important guards, and ones whose families hailed from Otterlin. Her sister had raged any time it happened. But Nezrin had known that if she'd exploded to her superiors, if she'd challenged them, they were the sort of men who would tell her to be grateful to be admitted at all, then demand she turn in her sword and uniform. So she'd figured it was better to remain, to be passed over, not for mere pay, but for the fact that there were so few other guards like her, helping those who needed it most. It was for them she stayed on, kept her head down while lesser men were appointed. Ah, another beat of quiet from the prince. I've heard they were not so welcoming toward people from other lands, to say the least. The words were colder than she'd meant. And yet that was where her father had insisted they live, thinking it offered some sort of better life. Even when Otterlin had launched its wars to conquer the northern continent, he'd stayed. Though her mother had tried to convince him to return to Antica, the city of her heart. Yet for whatever reason, perhaps stubbornness, perhaps defiance against the people who wanted to throw him out again, he'd stayed. And Nezrin tried not to fault him for it. She really did. Her sister couldn't understand it. Nezrin's occasional simmering anger on the topic. No. Dalara had always loved Rifthold. Loved the bustle of the city and thrived on winning over its hard-edged people. It had been no surprise that she'd married a man born and raised in the city itself. A true child of Otterlin. That's what her sister was. At least, of what Otterlin had once been, and might one day again become. Kadara caught a swift wind and coasted along it, the world below passing in a blur, as those towering mountains grew closer and closer. Sartak asked quietly, "Were you ever..." "It's not worth talking about." Not when she could sometimes still feel that rock as it collided with her head, hear the taunts of those children. She swallowed and added, "Your Highness." A low laugh. "So my title makes an appearance again." But he didn't press further. He only said, "I'm going to beg you not to call me Prince or Your Highness around the other riders."
"You're going to beg me, or you are?"
His arms tightened around her in mock warning. "It took me years to get them to stop asking if I needed my silk slippers or servants to brush my hair." Nezrin chuckled. "Amongst them, I am simply Sartek," he added. "Or Captain."
"Captain?"
"Another thing you and I have in common, it seems."
Shameless flirt indeed. "But you rule all 6 root clans. They answer to you."
"They do, and when we all gather, I am Prince. But amongst my family's own clan, the Aridin, I captain their forces and obey the word of my hearth mother."
He squeezed her again for emphasis.
"Which I'd advise you doing as well, if you don't want to be stripped and tied to a cliff face in the middle of a storm."
Holy gods.
Indeed.
Did she...
"Yes, and as you said, it's not worth talking about."
But Nezrin chuckled again, surprised to find her face aching from smiling so often these past few minutes. "I appreciate the warning, Captain."
The Tavern Mountains turned mammoth, a wall of dark gray stone higher than any she'd ever beheld in her own lands. Not that she'd seen many mountains up close. Her family had rarely ventured inland into Otterlin or its surrounding kingdoms, mostly because her father had been busy, but partially because the rural people in those areas did not take so well to outsiders. Even when their children had been born on Otterlanian soil, with an Otterlanian mother.
Sometimes that latter fact had been more enraging to them. Nezrin only prayed that the Rukin would be more welcoming. In all her father's stories, the descriptions of the Ares of the Rukin somehow still did not convey the sheer impossibility of what had been built into the sides and atop three towering peaks clustered in the heart of the Tavan Mountains. It was no assortment of gear, framed wide tents, that the horse clans moved about the steps. No. The Aridan Airy had been hewn into the stone, houses and halls and chambers, many of them originally nests for the Rooks themselves. Some of those nests remained, usually near a Rook's rider and their family, so the birds could be summoned at a moment's notice, either through a whistled command or by someone climbing the countless rope ladders anchored to the stone itself, allowing movement between various homes and caves, though internal stairwells had also been built within the peaks themselves, mostly for the elderly and children. The homes themselves each came equipped with a broad cave mouth for the Rooks to land, the living quarters hewn behind them. A few windows dotted the rock face here and there, markers of rooms hidden behind the stone, and drawing fresh air to the chambers within. Not that they needed much more fresh air here. The wind was a river between the three close-knit peaks that housed Sartak's hearth clan, full of Rooks of various sizes soaring or flapping or diving. Nezrin tried and failed to count the dwellings carved into the mountains. There had to be hundreds here, and perhaps more lay within the mountains themselves. This is only one clan? Her first words in hours. Kadara soared up the face of the centermost peak. Nezrin slid back in the saddle, Sartak's body a warm wall behind her as he leaned forward, guiding her to do so as well. His thighs bracketed hers, the muscles shifting beneath as he kept their balance with the stirrups.
The Aridan is one of the largest. The oldest, if we're to be believed.
You're not?
The area around them had indeed seemed to have existed for untold ages.
Every clan claims it is the oldest and first among riders.
A laugh that rumbled into her body.
When there is a gathering, you should only hear the arguments about it. You're better off to insult a man about his wife than to tell him to his face that your clan is the eldest.
Nezrin smiled, even as she squeezed her eyes shut against the sheer drop behind her. Kadara aimed, swift and unfaltering, for the broadest of overhangs. A veranda, she realized, as the Rook banked toward it. People were already standing just beneath the enormous arch of the cave mouth, arms raised in greeting. She felt Sartak's smile at her ear.
There lies the mountain hall of Altun, the home of my hearth mother and my family.
Altun. Windhaven was the rough translation. It was indeed larger than any other dwelling amid the three peaks, the Durgos, or Three Singers, they were called. The cave itself at least 40 feet tall and thrice as wide. Far within, she could just make out pillars and what indeed seemed to be a massive hall.
The reception court, where we host our meetings and celebrations,
Sartak explained, his arms tightening around her just as Kadara backflapped. Squeezing her eyes shut again in front of the awaiting people would certainly not win her any admiration. But Nezrin gripped the saddle horn with one hand, the other clenching Sartak's knee, braced behind hers. Hard enough to bruise. The prince only laughed quietly.
So the famed archer does have a weakness, then?
I'll find out yours soon enough,
Nezrin countered, earning another soft laugh in reply. The Rook mercifully made a smooth landing on the polished dark stone of the almost balcony, those waiting at the entrance bracing themselves against the wind off her wings. Then they were still, and Nezrin quickly straightened, releasing her death grip on both saddle and prince, to behold a hall full of pillars of carved painted wood. The braziers burning throughout cast the gold paint glinting amongst the green and red, and thick carpets in bold, striking patterns covered much of the stone floor, interrupted only by a round table,
and what seemed to be a small dais against one of the far walls. And beyond it, the gloom brightened by bracketed torches. A hallway flowed into the mountain itself, lined with doors. But in the very center of the mountain hall of Altoon, a fire. The pit had been carved into the floor, so deep and wide that layers of broad steps led down to it. Like a small amphitheater, the main entertainment not a stage but the flame itself, the hearth. It was indeed a domain fit for the winged prince. Nezrin squared her shoulders as people young and old pressed forward, smiling broadly. Some were clad in familiar riding leathers. Some wore beautifully colored heavy wool coats that flowed to their knees. Most possessed Sartak's silken onyx hair and wind-chapped golden-brown skin. "Well, well," drawled a young woman in a cobalt and ruby coat, tapping her booted foot on the smooth rock floor as she peered up at them. Nezrin forced herself to keep still, to endure that sweeping stare. The young woman's twin braids, tied with bands of red leather, fell well past her breasts, and she brushed one over a shoulder as she said, "Look who decided to give up his fur muff and oiled baths to join us once more." Nezrin schooled her face into a careful calm. But Sartak just dropped Kadara's reins, the prince giving Nezrin a distinct I-told-you-so look, before he said down to the girl, "Don't pretend that you haven't been praying I bring back more of those pretty silk slippers for you, Borte." Nezrin bit her lip to keep from smiling, though the others certainly showed no such restraint as their chuckles rumbled off the dark stones. Borte crossed her arms. "I suppose you'd know where to buy them, since you're so fond of wearing them yourself." Sartak laughed, the sound rich and merry. It was an effort not to gawk. He had not made such a laugh, not once, at the palace. And when had she last made such a bright sound? Even with her aunt and uncle, her laughter had been restrained, as if some invisible damper lay over her. Perhaps long before that, stretching back to the days when she was only a city guard with no idea what crawled through the sewers of Rifthold. Sartak smoothly dismounted Kadara and offered a hand to help Nezrin down. It was the hand he lifted that made the dozen or so gathered notice her, study her, none more closely than Borte. Another shrewd, weighing look, seeing the leathers, but none of the features that marked her as one of them. She dealt with the judgment of strangers long before now. This was nothing new. Even if she now stood in the gilded halls of Altoon, amongst the Rukin. Ignoring Sartak's offered hand, Nezrin forced her stiff body to smoothly slide one leg over the saddle and dismount herself. Her knees popped at the impact, but she managed to land lightly and didn't let herself touch her hair, which she was certain was a rat's nest despite her short braid. A faint gleam of approval entered Borte's dark eyes just before the girl jerked her chin toward Nezrin. "A Balruni woman in the leathers of a Rukin. Now there's a sight." Sartak didn't answer. He only glanced in Nezrin's direction. An invitation. And challenge. So Nezrin slipped her hands into the pockets of her close-fitting pants and sauntered to the prince's side. "Will it be improved if I tell you I caught Sartak filing his nails this morning?" Borte stared at Nezrin, blinking once. Then she tipped back her head and howled. Sartak threw an approving yet beleaguered glance in Nezrin's direction before saying, "Meet my hearth sister, Borte, granddaughter and heir of my hearth mother, Hulun." He reached between them to tug one of Borte's braids. She batted his hand away. "Borte, meet Captain Nezrin Falik." He paused for a breath, then added, "Of the Royal Guard of Otterlin." Silence. Borte's arched dark brows rose. An aging man in Rukin leathers pressed forward.
"But what is more unusual? That a Balruni woman is their captain, or that a captain of Otterlin has ventured so far?"
Borte waved the man off. "Always the idle chatter and questions with you," she scolded him. And to Nezrin's shock, the man winced and shut his mouth. The real question is, a sly grin at Sartak, does she come as emissary or bride? Any attempt at a steady, cool, calm appearance vanished as Nezrin gaped at the girl. Right as Sartak snapped, Borte! Borte gave a downright wicked grin. Sartak never brings such pretty ladies home, from Otterlin or Antica. Be careful walking around the cliff edges, Captain Falik, or some of the girls here might give you a shove. Will you be one of them? Nezrin's voice remained unruffled, even if her face had heated. Borte scowled. I should think not. Some of the others laughed again. As my hearth sister, Sartak explained, leading Nezrin toward the cluster of low-backed chairs near the lip of the fire pit. I consider Borte a blood relative, like my own sister. Borte's devilish grin faded as she fell into step alongside Sartak. How fares your family? Sartak's face was unreadable, save for the faint flicker in those dark eyes. Busy, was all he said. A non-answer. But Borte nodded, as if she knew his moods and inclinations well, and kept quiet while Sartak escorted Nezrin into a carved and painted wooden chair. The heat from the blazing fire was delicious, and she nearly groaned as she stretched out her frozen feet toward it. Borte hissed. You couldn't get your sweetheart a proper pair of boots, Sartak. Sartak growled in warning, but Nezrin frowned at her supple leather boots. They'd been more expensive than any she'd ever dared purchase for herself. But Dorian Havilyard had insisted. Part of the uniform, he'd told her with a wink. She wondered if he still smiled so freely, or spent as generously, wherever he was. But she glanced toward Borte, whose boots were leather, yet thicker, lined with what seemed to be thickest sheepskin. Definitely better equipped for the chilly altitudes. I'm sure you can dig up a pair somewhere, Sartak said to his hearth sister. And Nezrin twisted in her chair while the two of them drifted back toward where Kadara waited. The people pressed in around Sartak, murmuring too softly for Nezrin to hear from across the hall. But the prince spoke with easy smiles, talking while he unloaded their packs, handing them off to whoever was closest, and then unsaddled Kadara. He gave the golden rook a stroke down her neck, then a solid thump on her side. And then Kadara was gone, flapping into the open air beyond the cave mouth. Nezrin debated going over to them, offering to help with the packs that were now being hauled through the chamber and into the hallway beyond. But the heat creeping up her body had sapped the strength from her legs. Sartak and Borte appeared, the others dispersing, just as Nezrin noticed the man sitting near a brazier across the hall. A cup curling with steam sat on the small wooden table beside his chair, and though there seemed to be an open scroll in his lap, his eyes remained fixed on her. She didn't know what to remark upon. That while his skin was tan, it was clear that he did not hail from the southern continent, that his short brown hair was far from the long silken braids of the Rook Riders, or that his clothes seemed more akin to Otterlin's jackets and pants. Only a dagger hung at his side, and while he was broad-shouldered and fit, he didn't possess the self-assured swagger, the pitiless surety of a warrior. He was perhaps in his late 40s, pale white lines etched at the corner of his eyes, where he'd squinted in the sun or wind. Borte led Sartak around the fire pit, past the various pillars, and right to the man, who got to his feet and bowed. He stood roughly at Sartak's height, and even from across the hall, with the crackling fire and groaning wind, Nezrin could make out his shoddy halha.
It is an honor, Prince.
Borte snorted. Sartak just gave a curt nod and replied in the northern language. I'm told you have been a guest of our hearth mother for the past few weeks.
She was gracious enough to welcome me here, yes?
The man sounded slightly relieved to be using his native tongue. A glance toward Nezrin. She didn't bother to pretend she wasn't listening.
I couldn't help but overhear what I thought was mention of a captain from Otterlin.
Captain Felique oversees the Royal Guard.
The man didn't take his eyes off Nezrin, as he murmured.
Does she now?
Nezrin only held his stare from across the room.
Go ahead, gawk all you like.
Sartak asked sharply,
And your name?
The man dragged his gaze back to the prince.
Falcon Inar.
Borte said to Sartak in Halha, He is a merchant. And if he'd come from the northern continent? Nezrin slid to her feet, her steps near silent as she approached. She made sure they were, as Falcon watched her the entire way, running an eye over her from foot to head. Made sure he noted that the grace with which she moved was not some feminine gift, but from training that had taught her how to creep up on others undetected. Falcon stiffened, as if he finally realized it, and understood that the dagger at his side would be of little use against her, if he was stupid enough to pull something. Good. It made him smarter than a great number of men in Rifthold. Stopping a casual distance away, Nezrin asked the merchant,
Have you any news?
Up close. The eyes she'd mistaken for dark were a midnight sapphire. He'd likely been moderately handsome in his youth.
News of what?
Of Otterlin, of anything. Falcon stood with remarkable stillness, a man perhaps used to holding his ground in a bargain.
I wish that I could offer you any, Captain, but I have been in the southern continent for over 2 years now. You probably have more news than I do, a subtle request,
and one that would go unanswered. She was not about to blab her kingdom's business for all to hear. So Nezrin just shrugged and turned back toward the fire pit across the hall.
Before I left the northern continent, Falcon said as she strode away, a young man named Westfall was the captain of the Royal Guard. Are you his replacement?
Careful. She indeed had to be so careful not to reveal too much. To him. To anyone. Lord Westfall is now hand to King Dorian Havilyard. Shock slackened the merchant's face. She marked it, every tick and flicker. No joy or relief, but no anger either. Just surprise. Honest, bald surprise.
Dorian Havilyard is king?
At Nezrin's raised brows, Falcon explained.
I have been in the deep wilds for months now. News does not come swiftly, or often.
An odd place to be selling your goods,
Sartak murmured. Nezrin was inclined to agree. Falcon merely gave the prince a tight smile. A man with secrets of his own, then. It has been a long journey, Borte cut in, looping her arm through Nezrin's and turning her toward the dim hallway beyond. Captain Felique needs refreshment. And a bath. Nezrin wasn't certain whether to thank the young woman or begrudge her for interrupting. But her stomach was indeed an aching pit, and it had been a long while since she'd bathed. Neither Sartak nor Falcon stopped them, though their murmuring resumed as Borte escorted her into the hallway that shot straight into the mountain itself. Wooden doors lined it. Some open to reveal small bedchambers, even a little library. He is a strange man, Borte said in Halha. My grandmother refuses to speak of why he came here, what he seeks. Nezrin lifted a brow. Trade, perhaps? Borte shook her head, opening a door halfway down the hall. The room was small, a narrow bed tucked against one wall, the other occupied by a trunk and a wooden chair. The far wall held a wash basin and ewer, along with a pile of soft-looking clothes. We have no goods to sell. We are usually the merchants, ferrying goods across the continent. Our clan here, not so much, but some of the others. Their areas are full of treasures from every territory. She towed the rickety bed and frowned.
Not this old junk.
Nezrin chuckled. Perhaps he wishes to assist you in expanding, then.
Borte turned, braids swaying. No. He doesn't meet with anyone or seem interested in that.
A shrug.
It matters little, only that he is here. Nezrin folded away the tidbits of information. He didn't seem like one of Morath's agents. But who knew how far the arm of Erewhon now stretched? If it had reached Antica, then it was possible it had delved into the continent. She'd be on her guard. Had no doubt Sartak already was. Borte twirled the end of a braid around a finger. I saw the way you sized him up. You don't think he's here for business, either.
Nezrin weighed the merits of admitting the truth and opted for, These are strange days for all of us. I have learned not to take men on their word or appearance.
Borte dropped her braid. No wonder Sartak brought you home. You sound just like him.
Nezrin hid her smile, not bothering to say that she found such a thing to be a compliment.
Borte sniffed, waving to the room. Not as fine as the Coggins Palace, but better than sleeping on one of Sartak's shitty bedrolls.
Nezrin smiled. Any bed is better than that, I suppose.
Borte smirked. I meant what I said. You need a bath and a comb. Nezrin at last raised a hand to her hair and winced. Tangles and knots and more tangles. Just getting it out of the braid would be a nightmare. Even Sartak braids better than that, Borte teased.
Nezrin sighed. Despite my sister's best efforts to teach me, I'm useless when it comes to such things. She offered the girl a wink. Why do you think I keep my hair so short?
Indeed, her sister had practically fainted when Nezrin had come home one afternoon at age 15, with hair cut to her collarbone. She'd kept the hair that length ever since. In part to piss off Delara, who still pouted about it, and partially because it was far easier to deal with. Wielding blades and arrows was one thing, but styling hair? She was hopeless. And showing up at the guards' barracks with a pretty hairstyle would not have been well received. Borte only gave Nezrin a curt nod, as if she seemed to realize that. Before you fly the next time, I'll braid it properly for you. Then she pointed down the hall, to a set of narrow stairs that led into the gloom. Baths are this way. Nezrin sniffed herself and cringed. Oh, that's awful. Borte snickered as Nezrin entered the hall. I'm surprised Sartak's eyes weren't watering. Nezrin chuckled as she followed her toward what she prayed was a boiling hot bath. She again felt Borte's sharp assessing gaze and asked, What? You grew up in Otterlin, didn't you? Nezrin considered the question, why it might be asked.
Yes. I was born and raised in Rifthold, though my father's family comes from Antica.
Borte was quiet for a few steps. But as they reached the narrow stairwell and stepped into the dim interior, Borte smiled over a shoulder at Nezrin. Then welcome home. Nezrin wondered if those words might be the most beautiful she'd ever heard. The baths were ancient copper tubs that had to be filled kettle by kettle, but Nezrin didn't object as she finally slid into one. An hour later, hair finally detangled and brushed out, she found herself seated at the massive round table in the great hall, shoveling roast rabbit into her mouth, nestled in thick, warm clothes that had been donated by Borte herself. The flashes of embroidered cobalt and daffodil on the sleeves snared Nezrin's attention as much as the platters of roast meats before her. Beautiful clothes, layered and toasty against the chill that permeated the hall, even with the fires. And her toes. Borte had indeed found a pair of those fleece-lined boots for her. Sartak sat beside Nezrin at the empty table, equally silent and eating with as much enthusiasm. He had yet to bathe, though his windblown hair had been rebraided, the long plait falling down the center of his muscled back. As her belly began to fill, and her fingers slowed their picking,
Nezrin glanced toward the prince. She found him smiling faintly.
Better than grapes and salted pork.
She jerked her chin toward the bones littering her plate in silent answer. Then to the grease on her fingers. Would it be uncouth to lick it off? The seasonings had been exquisite.
My hearth mother,
he said, that smile fading,
is not here.
Nezrin paused her eating. They come here to seek the counsel of this woman. According to Borte, she will be returning tomorrow or the day after. She waited for more. Silence could be just as effective as spoken questions. Sartak pushed back his plate and braced his arms on the table.
I'm aware that you're pressed for time. If I could, I'd go look for her myself, but even Borte wasn't sure where she'd gone off to. Hulan is adrift like that. Sees her Sulde waving in the wind and takes her Rook out to chase it. And will whack us with it if we try to stop her.
A gesture toward the rack of spears near the cave mouth. Sartak's own Sulde among them. Nezrin smiled at that. She sounds like an interesting woman.
She is. In some ways, I'm closer to her than...
The words trailed off, and he shook his head. Than his own mother. Indeed, Nezrin hadn't witnessed him being nearly so open, so teasing with his own siblings, as he was with Borte. I can wait, Nezrin said at last, trying not to wince. Lord Westfall still needs time to heal. And I told him I'd be gone 3 weeks. I can wait a day or two more. And please, gods, not another moment after it. Sartak nodded, tapping a finger on the ancient wood of the table.
Tonight we will rest. But tomorrow...
A hint of a smile.
How would you like a tour tomorrow?
It would be an honor. Sartak's smile grew. Perhaps we could also do a bit of archery practice. He looked her over with a frankness that made her shift in her seat.
I'm certainly keen to match myself against Neith's arrow, and I'm sure the young warriors are, too.
Nezrin pushed back her own plate, brows lifting. They've heard of me? Sartak grinned.
I might have told a story or two the last time I came here. Why do you think there were so many people gathered when we arrived? They certainly don't usually bother to drag themselves here to see me.
But Borte seemed like she'd never...
Does Borte seem like a person who gives anyone an easy time?
Something deeper in her warmed. No. But how could they have known I was coming? His answering grin was the portrait of princely arrogance.
Because I sent word a day before that you were likely to join me.
Nezrin gaped at him. Unable to maintain that mask of calm. Rising, Sartak scooped up their plates.
I told you that I was praying you'd join me, Nezrin Falik. If I'd shown up empty-handed, Borte would have never let me hear the end of it.
Chapter 30 Within the interior chamber of the hall, Nezrin had no way of telling how long she'd slept, or what hour of the morning it was. She'd dozed fitfully, awakening to comb through the sounds beyond her door, to detect if anyone was astir. She doubted Sartak was the type to scold her for sleeping in. But if the Rukin indeed teased the prince about his courtly life, then lazing about all morning was perhaps not the best way to win them over. So she'd tossed and turned, catching a few minutes of sleep here and there, and gave up entirely when she noticed shadows interrupting the light cracking beneath the door. Someone, at least, was awake in the hall of Altoon. She'd dressed, pausing only to wash her face. The room was warm enough that the water in the ewer wasn't icy, though she certainly could have used a freezing splash on her gritty eyes. 30 minutes later, seated in the saddle before Sartak, she regretted that wish. He'd indeed been awake and saddling Kadara when she'd emerged into the still quiet Great Hall. The fire pit burned brightly, as if someone tended to it all night. But save for the prince and his Rook, the pillar-filled hall was empty. It was still empty when he hauled her up into the saddle and Kadara leaped from the cave mouth. Freezing air slammed into her face, whipping at her cheeks as they dove. A few other rooks were aloft, likely out for their breakfasts, Sartak told her, his voice soft in the emerging dawn. And it was in pursuit of Kadara's own meal that they went, sailing out of the three peaks of the Aridan Zeri and deep into the fur-crusted mountains beyond. It was only after Kadara had snatched half a dozen fat silver salmon from a rushing turquoise river, hurling them each in the air before swallowing them in a slicing bite, that Sartak steered them toward a cluster of smaller peaks.
"The training run,"
he said, pointing. The rocks were smoother, the drops between peaks less sharp, more like smooth, rounded gullies, where the novices learned to ride. Though less brutal than the three brother peaks of the Dorgos, it didn't seem any safer.
"You said you raised Kadara from a hatchling. Is that how it is done for all riders?"
"Not when we are first learning to ride. Children take out the seasoned, more docile rooks, ones too old to make long flights. We learn on them until we are 13, 14, and then find our hatchling to raise and train ourselves."
13.
"We take our first rides at 4. Or the others do. I was, as you know, a few years late." Nezrin pointed to the training run.
"You let 4-year-olds ride alone through that?"
"Family members or hearthkin usually go on the first several rides." Nezrin blinked at the little mountain range, trying and failing to imagine her various nieces and nephews, who were still prone to running naked and shrieking through the house at the mere whisper of the word bath, responsible for not only commanding one of the beasts beneath her, but staying in the saddle. "The horse clans on the steppes have the same training," Sartak explained. "Most can stand atop the horses by 6 and begin learning to wield bows and spears as soon as their feet can reach the stirrups. Aside from the standing," a chuckle at the thought, "our children have an identical process." The sun peeked out, warming the skin she'd left exposed to the biting wind. "It was how the first Khagan conquered the continent. Our people were already well-trained as a cavalry, disciplined and used to carrying their own supplies, the other armies they faced. Those kingdoms did not anticipate foes who knew how to ride across thick winter ice they believed would guard their cities during the cold months. And they did not anticipate an army that traveled light, engineers amongst them to craft weapons from any materials they found when they reached their destinations. To this day, the Academy of Engineers in Balrun remains the most prestigious in the Khaganate."
Nezrin knew that. Her father still mentioned the Academy every now and then.
A distant cousin had attended and gone on to earn a small degree of fame for inventing some harvesting machine. Sartak steered Kadara southward, soaring high above the snow-capped peaks. "Those kingdoms also didn't anticipate an army that conquered from behind, by taking routes that few would risk." He pointed to the west, toward a pale band along the horizon. "The Kazultum Desert lies that way. For centuries, it was a barrier between the steppes and the greener lands. To attempt to conquer the southern territories, everyone had always taken the long way around it, giving plenty of time for the defenders to rally a host. So when those kingdoms heard the Khagan and his 100,000 warriors were on the move, they positioned their armies to intercept them."
Pride limned his every word.
"Only to discover that the Khagan and his armies had directly crossed the Kazultum, befriending local nomads long sneered at by the southern kingdoms to guide them, allowing the Khagan to creep right behind them and sack their unguarded cities."
She felt his smile at her ear, and found herself settling a little farther into him. "What happened then?"
She'd only heard fragments of the stories, never such a sweeping account, and certainly not from the lips of one born to this glorious bloodline.
"Was it open war?"
"No," Sartak said. "He avoided outright combat whenever he could, actually. Made a brutal example of a few key leaders so that terror would spread, and by the time he reached many of those cities or armies, most laid down their arms and accepted his terms of surrender in exchange for protection. He used fear as a weapon,
just as much as he wielded his Sulde.
I heard he had two. Sulde, I mean.
He did. And my father still does. The ebony and the ivory, we call them. A Sulde with white horsehair to carry in times of peace, and one with black horsehair to wield in war.
I assume he brought the ebony with him on those campaigns.
Oh, he certainly did. And by the time he'd crossed the Khazul tomb and sacked that first city, word of what awaited resistance, word that he was indeed carrying the ebony Sulde, spread so quick and so far, that when he arrived at the next kingdom, they didn't even bother to raise an army. They just surrendered. The Khagan rewarded them handsomely for it, and made sure other territories heard of that too.
He was quiet for a moment.
Otterland's king was not so clever or merciful, was he?
No, Nezrin said, swallowing. He was not. The man had destroyed and pillaged and enslaved. Not the man, the demon within him. She added, the army that Erewhon has rallied. He began amassing it long before Dorian and Aelin matured and claimed their birthrights. Kaol, Lord Westfall, told me of tunnels and chambers beneath the palace in Rifthold that had been there for years. Places where human and Volg had been experimented upon. Right under the feet of mindless courtiers.
Which raises the question of why, Sartak mused. If he'd conquered most of the northern continent, why gather such a force? He thought Aelin Galathinius was dead. I assume he did not anticipate that Dorian Havilyard would turn rebel too.
She hadn't told him of the word keys,
and still couldn't bring herself to divulge them.
We've always believed that Erewhon was hell-bent on conquering this world. It seemed motive enough.
But you sound doubtful now,
Nezrin considered. I just don't understand why. Why all this effort? Why want to conquer more when he'd secretly controlled the northern continent anyway? Erewhon got away with plenty of horrors. Is it only that he wishes to plunge our world into further darkness? Does he wish to call himself master of the earth?
Perhaps things like motives and reason are foreign to demons. Perhaps he only has the drive to destroy.
Nezrin shook her head. Squinting against the sun, as it rose higher, the light turning blinding. Sartak returned to the Aridan Airy, left Kadara in the Great Hall, and continued Nezrin's tour.
He spared her the embarrassment of begging not to use the rope ladders along the cliff face, and led her through the internal stairwells and passageways of the mountain. To get to the other two peaks, he claimed, they'd need to either fly across or take one of the two bridges strung between them. One glance at the rope and wood, and Nezrin announced she could wait for another day to try. Riding on Kadara was one thing. Nezrin trusted the bird and trusted her rider. But the swaying bridge, however well built, she might need a drink or two before trying to cross. But there was plenty to see within the mountain itself. Rokal, the Whisperer, he was called. The other two brother peaks that made up the Dorgos were Eric, the Lilter, and Torque, the Roarer. All three named for the way the wind itself sang as it passed over and around them. Rokal was the biggest of them, the most delved, his crown jewel being the Hall of Altun near the top. But even in the chambers below Altun, Nezrin hardly knew where to look. As the prince showed her through the winding corridors and spaces. The various kitchens and small gathering halls. The rook riders' houses and workshops. The nests of various rooks, who ranged in color from Kadara's gold to dark brown. The smithies, where armor was forged from ore mined within the mountain. The tanneries, where the saddles were meticulously crafted. The trading posts, where one might barter for household goods and small trinkets. And lastly, atop Rokal himself, the training rings. There was no wall or fence along the broad, flat-topped summit. Only the small, round building that provided a reprieve from the wind and cold, as well as access to the stairwell beneath. Nezrin was out of breath by the time they opened the wooden door to the rasping wind.
and the sight that stretched before her certainly snatched away any remaining air in her lungs. Even flying above and amongst the mountains felt somehow different from this. Snow-capped dominating peaks surrounded them, ancient as the earth, untouched and slumbering. Nearby, a long lake sparkled between twin ridges, rooks mere shadows over the teal surface. She'd never seen anything so great and unforgiving, so vast and beautiful. And even though she was as insignificant as a mayfly compared with the size of the mountains around them, some piece of her felt keenly a part of it, born from it. Sartak stood at her side, following where her attention drifted, as if their gazes were bound together. And when Nezrin's stare landed upon a lonely, broad mountain on the other end of the lake, he drew in a swift breath. No trees grew on its dark sides. Only snow provided a cape over its uppermost crags and summit.
"That is Arundin,"
Sartak said softly, as if fearful of even the wind hearing.
"The fourth singer amid these peaks."
The wind indeed seemed to flow from the mountain, cold and swift.
"The Silent One, we call him."
Indeed, a heavy sort of quiet seemed to ripple around that peak. In the turquoise waters of the lake at his feet lay a perfect mirror image, so clear that Nezrin wondered if one might dive beneath the surface and find another world, a shadow world beneath.
"Why?"
Sartak turned, as if the sight of Arundin was not one to be endured for long.
"It is upon his slopes that the Rukin bury our dead. If we fly closer, you'll see Sulde covering his sides. The only markers of the fallen."
It was an entirely inappropriate and morbid question, but Nezrin asked, "Will you one day be laid there? Or out in the sacred land of the steppes with the rest of your family?" Sartak towed the smooth rock beneath them.
"That choice remains before me.
The two parts of my heart shall likely have a long war over it." She certainly understood it, that tug between two places. Shouts and clanging metal drew her attention from the beckoning eternal silence of Arundin to the real purpose of the space atop Rokal, the training rings. Men and women in riding leathers stood at various circles and stations. Some fired arrows at targets with impressive accuracy. Some hurled spears. Some sparred sword to sword. Older riders barked orders or corrected aim and posture, stalking amongst the warriors. A few turned in Sartak's direction as he and Nezrin approached the training ring at the far end of the space. The archery circuit. With the wind. The cold. Nezrin found herself calculating those factors, admiring the archer's skill all the more. And she was somehow not surprised to find Borte among the three archers, aiming at stuffed dummies, her long braids snapping in the wind. "Here to have your ass handed to you again, brother?" Borte's smirk was full of that wicked delight. Sartak let out his rich, pleasant laugh again, taking up a longbow and shouldering a quiver from the stand nearby. He nudged his hearth sister aside with a bump of the hip, knocking an arrow with ease. He aimed, fired, and Nezrin smiled as the arrow found its mark, right in the neck of the dummy.
"Impressive, for a princeling," Borte drawled.
She turned to Nezrin, her dark brows high.
"And you?"
"Well then," swallowing her smile, Nezrin shrugged out of the heavier wool overcoat, gave Borte an incline of her head, and approached the rack of arrows and bows. The mountain wind was bracing with only her riding leathers for warmth, but she blocked out Rokal's whispering as she ran her fingers down the carved wood.
"Yew, ash."
She plucked up one of the yew bows, testing its weight, its flexibility and resistance. A solid, deadly weapon. Yet familiar. As familiar as an old friend. She had not picked up a bow until her mother's death. And during those initial years of grief and numbness, the physical training, The concentration and strength required had been a sanctuary and a reprieve and forge. She wondered if any of her old tutors had survived the attack on Rifthold. If any of their arrows had brought down wyverns or slowed them enough to save lives. Nezrin let the thought settle as she moved to the quivers, pulling out arrows. The metal tips were heavier than those she'd used in Otterlin, the shaft slightly thicker, designed to cut through brutal winds at racing speeds. Perhaps, if they were lucky, take out a wyvern or two. She selected arrows from various quivers, setting them into her own before she strapped it across her back, and approached the line where Borte, Sartak, and a few others were silently watching. "Pick a mark," Nezrin told Borte. The woman smirked. "Neck, heart, head." She pointed to each of the three dummies, a different mark for each one. Wind rattled them. The aim and strength needed to hit each utterly different. Borte knew it. All the warriors here did. Nezrin lifted an arm behind her head, dragging her fingers along the fletching, the feathers rippling against her skin as she scanned the three targets, listened to the murmur of the winds racing past Rokal, that wild summons she heard echoed in her own heart. Wind Seeker, her mother had called her. One after another, Nezrin withdrew an arrow and fired, again and again and again. Again and again and again. Again and again and again. And when she finished, only the howling wind answered. The wind of Torque, the roarer. Every training ring had stopped, staring at what she'd done. Instead of three arrows distributed amongst the three dummies, she'd fired nine, three rows of perfectly aligned shots on each, heart, neck, and head. Not an inch of difference, even with the singing winds. Sartak was grinning when she turned to him, his long braid drifting behind him, as if it were a Sulde itself. But Borte elbowed past him and breathed to Nezrin, "Show me." For hours, Nezrin stood atop the Rokal training ring and explained how she'd done it, how she calculated wind and weight and air, and as much as she showed the various rotations that came through. They also demonstrated their own techniques, the way they twisted in their saddles to fire backward, which bows they wielded for hunting or warfare. Nezrin's cheeks were wind-chapped, her hands numb, but she was smiling, wide and unfailingly, when Sartak was approached by a breathless messenger who had burst from the stairwell entrance. His hearth mother had returned to the Eyrie at last. Sartak's face revealed nothing, though a nod from him had Borte ordering all the onlookers to go back to their various stations. They did so with a few grins of thanks and welcome to Nezrin, which she returned with an incline of her head. Sartak set his quiver and bow on the wooden rack, extending a hand for Nezrin's. She passed him both, flexing her fingers after hours of gripping bow and string. "She'll be tired," Borte warned him, a short sword in her hand. Her training apparently was not over for the day. "Don't pester her too much." Sartak threw an incredulous look at Borte. "You think I want to get smacked with a spoon again?" Nezrin choked at that, but shrugged into the embroidered cobalt and gold wool coat, belting it tightly. She trailed the prince as he headed into the warm interior, straightening her wind-tossed hair as they descended the dim stairwell. "Even though Borte is to one day lead the Aridon, she trains with the others?"
"Yes," Sartak said without glancing over his shoulder. "Hearthmothers all know how to fight, how to attack and defend. But Borte's training includes other things."
"Like learning the different tongues of the world." Her use of the northern language was as impeccable as Sartak's.
"Like that, and history and more. Things even I am not told of by either Borte or her grandmother."
The words echoed off the stones around them. Nezrin dared ask, "Where's Borte's mother?" Sartak's shoulders tensed.
Her Sulde stands on Arundin's slopes.
Just the way he spoke it. The cold cut of his voice. I'm sorry.
So am I,
was all Sartak said. Her father?
A man her mother met in distant lands, and whom she did not care to hold on to for longer than a night.
Nezrin considered the fierce, wicked young woman, who'd fought with no small skill in the training rings. I'm glad she has you, then. And her grandmother.
Sartak shrugged.
Dangerous, strange territory. She'd somehow waded into a place where she had no right to pry. But then Sartak said, You're a good teacher. Thank you. It was all she could think to say. He kept close to her side while she walked the others through her various positions and techniques, but had said little. A leader who did not need to constantly be filling the air with talking and boasting. He blew out a breath, shoulders loosening.
And I'm relieved to see that the reality lives up to the legend.
Nezrin chuckled, grateful to be back on safer ground. You had doubts?
They reached the landing that would take them to the Great Hall.
Sartak let her fall into step beside him.
The reports left out some key information. It made me doubt their accuracy.
It was the sly gleam in his eye that made Nezrin angle her head. What exactly did they fail to mention?
They reached the Great Hall, empty save for a cloaked figure just barely visible on the other side of the fire pit, and someone sitting beside her.
But Sartak turned to her, examining her from head to toe and back again. There was little that he missed.
They didn't mention that you're beautiful.
Nezrin opened and closed her mouth in what she was sure was an unflattering impression of a fish on dry land. With a wink, Sartak strode ahead, calling,
Edge!
The Rukin's term for mother, he'd told her this morning. Nezrin hurried after him.
They rounded the massive fire pit,
the figure sitting atop the uppermost stair pulling back her hood. She'd expected an ancient crone, bent with age and toothless. Instead, a straight-backed woman with braided, silver-streaked onyx hair smiled grimly at Sartak. And though age had indeed touched her features, it was Borte's face, or Borte's face in 40 years. The Hearthmother wore a rider's leathers, though her dark blue cloak, actually a jacket she left hanging over her shoulders, covered much of them. But at her side, Falcon. His face equally grave, those dark sapphire eyes scanning them. Sartak checked his pace at the sight of the merchant, either irritated that he hadn't been first to claim her attention, or simply that the merchant was present for this reunion. Manners or self-preserving instincts kicked in, and Sartak continued his approach, hopping down onto the first ledge of the pit to stride the rest of the way. Hulan rose when he was near, enfolding him in a swift, hard embrace. She cupped his shoulders when she was done, the woman nearly as tall as him. Shoulders strong and thighs well-muscled, and surveyed Sartak with a shrewd eye. Sorrow weighs heavily on you still, she observed, running a scar-flecked hand over Sartak's high cheekbone. And worry. Sartak's eyes shuddered before he ducked his head.
I have missed you, Edge.
Sweet talker, Hulan chided, patting his cheek. To Nezrin's delight, she could have sworn the prince blushed. The firelight cast the few strands of silver in Hulan's hair with red and gold, as she peered around Sartak's broad shoulders to where Nezrin stood atop the lip of the pit. And the archer from the north arrives at last. An incline of her head. I am Hulan, daughter of Dochen. But you may call me Edge, as the others do. One glance into the woman's brown eyes, and Nezrin knew Hulan was not one who missed much. Nezrin bowed her head. It is an honor. The Hearthmother stared at her for a long moment. Nezrin met her gaze, remaining as still as she could, letting the woman see what she wanted. At last, Hulan's eyes slid toward Sartak. We have matters to discuss. Absent that fierce gaze,
Nezrin loosed a breath, but kept her spine ramrod straight. Sartak nodded.